We'd like to welcome everybody to the Mesa City Council study session for Monday, April 20th, 2009. We'd like to excuse council members Dave Richens and Dina Higgins, who are out of town attending a town hall event and will not be joining us phone. We'll begin with the first item on our agenda, which is to hear a presentation on clean air from County Supervisor Don Stapley and friends. Supervisor Stapley, welcome to our meeting. Appreciate you being here.
Excellent. Mayor Smith, Council Member Scott Boucher, the Deputy Development and Sustainability Director. It's my pleasure today to introduce County Supervisor Don Stapley, who they'll be discussing today with Holly Ward, and they'll be discussing the Clean Air Make More campaign with Maricopa County. As some of you are aware, but and maybe some not, that City of Mesa has worked for many years as a partner with Maricopa County. We were the first city to adopt a specific particulate pollution ordinance, which all the other cities have now followed our direction on that. We were also one of the first cities to do dust inspections of private construction lots. So we really have for many years been working cooperatively with Maricopa County, and we continue to do so. And I think with the presentation today, you'll see some of the areas that we are working together. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Supervisor Stapley.
Thank you, Scott, and thank you, Mayor and Council members. It is indeed a pleasure to be with you. And for those of us who were able to go through the mobile unit that's set up out back, it was the first time I've seen it. So I was learning along with you, and those who didn't take the time or didn't have the time, it will be here after the meeting. You'd be welcome to take a look and get a quick tour. The region of Maricopa County, as you all know, is under the federal designation of serious non-attainment by the Environmental Protection Agency. As a result, we've been mandated to clean the air or risk losing up to $7 billion in federal highway project funding. I don't have to tell you that there's a problem with the air out there, but I do want to ask you to continue with the vigilance and the help and the partnering that you have demonstrated in the past, and I know that you will do that and that's your desire. We need to work together to clean up the air. Every individual, every business, every community, every neighborhood, the entire region has to work together. No one is exempted from this problem, because everyone, in actuality, everyone contributes to some degree to our air quality, either positively or negatively. Maricopa County Board of Supervisors are committed to clean air. In 2008, we approved some of the most stringent air quality regulation in the history of this county. This affects everyone from leaf blowers to the fireplace use, to construction, to mining activity, and on. We've approved funds to purchase this equipment similar to what you see upstairs, the air monitoring programs, sophisticated software, computerized systems to really do a better job in the 28 fixed air quality monitoring stations around the region, as well as a mobile unit like the one you see upstairs to be used in spot checks and other needs. Finally, members of the council and mayor, we have recently gone through a nationwide search for a new air quality department director, and we're pleased that we were able to find Lawrence Odell, and he has been on board for several months now. He comes with a stellar record of achievement, as well as a past history of success in turning around a region that had similar problems to ours. Unfortunately, Mr. Odell has got a bad case of laryngitis and could not be here tonight. If he were, he couldn't say anything. So we have Holly Ward, our able assistant, and I don't know your title, Holly, so you'll have to share that again.
I can maybe make one up.
Yeah. I'll turn it over to Holly.
Thank you, Mayor and members of council. I am Holly Ward. I'm the public information officer for Maricopa County's Air Quality Department, and thank you for the introduction and framework of the issues. I want to take a brief moment to recognize some of our staff that have traveled out here to Mesa tonight. Behind me are, if you would stand up, Frank Schinzel. He's a dust inspector with our department, and he's our official city and town liaison that helps folks understand our rules and works closely with Scott, as he was saying, on environmental issues for the city of Mesa. Also, Dennis Dickerson, who is our air quality ombudsman. Dennis started with us about a month ago, and his goal and purpose is to help us liaise with industry, members of industry, when enforcement action, permitting action comes into play. Dennis works with those folks. And then also apologies for Director Odell, who really wanted to be here tonight, but I just went out because my voice will carry this evening. So with that, I'll start with our presentation. And can you see the slideshow? Okay, great. On the monitors in front of you. Director Odell likes to start out framing up the issue of air quality in Maricopa County. And as you can see, his point is, as long as man continues to attempt to attain higher standards of living, there will be air pollution. This is a great framework slide that puts it in perspective. Air quality regulation has been in place for a long time. As you can see, some of these incidents, including the first one, King Henry VIII, whosoever shall be found a burning coal within the sound of my voice shall suffer. Maybe Director Odell would have been better. Shall suffer the loss of his head. So as you can see, air pollution regulation has come a long way, fortunately for all of us. To take a look at the issues, Maricopa County, by federal guideline, cannot go over the levels of our monitors no more than three times within 3 years. Here's a breakdown of those numbers at exactly how many times we've gone way above the three times within 3 years. It is pretty bad. What are the consequences? There are several. The loss of $7 billion in transportation project funding is at risk. We have increasingly stringent air quality regulations. As Supervisor Stapley mentioned, our Board of Supervisors approved some new tougher rules last year that are now in effect. And then above all else, it's the health impact. So it's the breathing that we do that's a key to our everyday life. Just a quick look at some of our emissions inventory. This is the particulate or PM10 emissions that are sources. This you probably are familiar with. These are the committed control measures in the MAG 5% plan. And so what is Maricopa County doing? We are truly at your service. We are working to achieve that 5% plan, first and foremost through public outreach, a big reason why we are here tonight, and we thank you for inviting us. But public outreach is the first measure on the MAG 5% plan of about 53 measures. Public outreach is number one. We'll talk more about our educational campaign in a moment. But here are some other things that we're doing, including increasing training and compliance, revising rules and ordinances, and also on the horizon, we're looking to create an advisory committee. This would be a balanced stakeholder committee with citizens, industry, and municipalities alike. We have a lot of ambitious goals, but one is very common. The number one goal for our department is to decrease the number of days that we exceed the standard. We just have to reduce that, get that back down to within the EPA guideline. We need to engage everyone to take action. As Supervisor Stapley was saying, we cannot do this alone. Everyone needs to take part. We recently held in February a workshop with cities and towns. And we wanted to briefly recap some of that just to bring that home to you here in the city of Mesa. Here is some of the issues identified during that survey with training, dust palliatives, resources. Another slide dealing with equipment sharing, public outreach, and enforcement. These are all issues that members of local municipalities told us were important to them. So these are issues that we're going to identify ways how we can work better, work smarter. You saw the van outside. The slide just doesn't do it justice when you saw it in person. I hope that you all got a chance to go out, walk through the van. Ben Davis, our air monitoring manager, and his staff are out there interested in showing you one brand new tool that we have in the air quality fight. So now on to my favorite, our public outreach campaign. We started Clean Air, Make More. We launched that the beginning of this year. We wanted to turn our messaging, our public outreach campaign, into an action-oriented campaign. This one you'll see on the Clean Air, Make More, we have positive action items. We wanted to turn this into something where we caught people's attention last year into a focused, action-oriented campaign. Here are some of the avenues that we're doing that through: our billboards. We've done radio ads, brochures, posters, and flyers that we hand out at events. community presentations, including council presentations like this. And our main goal is to announce no burn days declared on a health watch or high pollution advisory. We do this through our website, our cleanairmakemore.com website. On there, we have some pretty neat tools that we've announced and launched. One is a widget. I had not heard of what it was before, so in case there's someone like me out there, a widget is a desktop icon. It sits on your computer desktop, and it carries the current air quality information. So it tells you what the air is doing out there, tells you if there are restrictions in place, and basically what's going on with your air quality that you're breathing. We also serve or send out text alerts on your cell phone or email blasts. The point being is we want to educate people. If it's a bad air day, we need everyone to take action and help us keep the pollution down so that, again, we reduce those number of times we exceed the health-based standard. So who's involved? I think we tried to cover a lot of people on this slide, and pretty much everybody is covered in this slide. But here's what we ask of the City of Mesa. Mayor and members of the council, we ask that first and foremost you be our clean air champion. We are looking for someone to help us by being providing leadership and developing local outreach efforts. I know that you have meetings with your constituents and residents, and you can get to people where we cannot. And we have a tool for you to deliver some positive information to your constituents and your residents. So with that, here is our ask for tonight. We ask for a clean air ambassador. Here are some of the ideas to help get you started. You may have better ideas to tell us what you can do, but we ask that you add a Clean Air Make More link on your website. Send out an email to your residents. We have all the tools and information for you, are prepared to hand them over to you, just need help in getting the word out. So Channel 11 opportunities abound, citizen newsletters and ongoing mailings to residents, we're prepared to offer you. And then finally, we just ask that you make the clean air commitment. By doing that, you go to our website, cleanairmakemore.com, sign up to make the clean air commitment, and join us in this battle to clean the air. With that, I think Supervisor Stapley and I are happy to take any questions you might have.
First of all, we've all decided that since most of the pollution comes out of District 5, and since Dina isn't here, we've appointed her as our ambassador.
Second.
I think Vice Mayor had a question or comment.
Back on the pie chart of the emissions, the two largest ones, 17% each, had to do with dust on roadways, unpaved. Help us understand, we have a lot of county island area out in Northeast Mesa that there's a lot of dirt roads. How can you help us in that arena as far as getting the abatement on those dirt roads out there?
The short answer is we're going to pave them. And we have paved many, many miles of those county island dirt roads. The problem is they continue to escalate. And so, you know, I've encouraged many of those residents to annex into the City of Mesa. I believe that once the city surrounds areas like that, that it's an option to stay in the county, but oftentimes it just makes a lot of sense for them to annex into the city. Now, does that bring pavement to their streets? No, it doesn't, but we're working in every way we can through improvement districts locally with residents and others to create those improvement districts to pave those less traveled streets and the streets where we've been able to obtain federal funding and regional funding from Prop 400. We've been able to pave, I wish I had the statistics, but in the last couple of years, we've paved a lot of those roads. And I believe there's a lot of money in the stimulus federal recovery act that will be going to those kinds of mitigation efforts.
Yeah, not in the transportation, but more in the clean air.
Correct.
And the environmental.
Well, it's coming from both.
Yeah. But, okay.
And Mr. Boucher, where are we on all of our road paving out in those areas?
Currently, the city of Mesa only has 0.1 miles of unpaved roads currently.
We have
paved all of our roads. The only ones those are really three separate roadways that go to well sites and those sort of things with restricted access, that it's just we really don't have an ability to pave those ones, but we really, in all essence, have no unpaved roads in the city of Mesa.
Okay.
I have a question. I get a lot of comment from people as they go out to a construction site, for example, and we see the construction sites are a big, they provide more than their fair share of dust and everything. And the question is, you're looking at two very valuable resources, clean air and water, and about the only way or one of the primary ways to keep dust down on a construction site is to use a lot of water. What's the balance there? How do you deal with that, or how do you answer people who say, you know, clean air is great, but here you are, have two guys with a hose sitting there using very valuable water just to keep dust down?
Mr. Mayor, members of the council, that's a very valid question, but we do encourage that water is just one use of one stabilization tool. There are other things that construction sites, by your example, can do to stabilize their property. But the point it gets down to is we need to keep that dust down. So whether that's using a soil stabilizer, gravel, rock to keep that down in areas that have been disturbed but maybe not used. Also the possible idea of grading the land only as you need it, as opposed to, it's not cost effective for the constructive entities, but when you grade a huge acreage of plot of land, a lot of that just stays what we call unstabilized, can easily float up into the air if someone drives on it and or the wind blows. So there are measures to take. Water is certainly probably a common use for stabilization, but there are other things that people can use. So we also encourage preservation of our natural resource water, but our goal is to reduce the number of times we exceed the standard and keep the dust down.
And the last question I have is what you've looked at or what you've presented is primarily an education outreach and a voluntary compliance. I know in construction and other areas there are some fines and some activities, enforcement activities, but you really think we can get there through education enforcement or education and outreach in that, or at what point do we have to step into the enforcement area where we start forcing people to change their ways that they do things rather than asking them?
Let me take a shot at it, Mr. Mayor, and then I'll ask Holly to fill in the blanks. We have been enforcing, particularly track out problems, because as you know, a track out site on a construction site drags a lot of the dirt and mud and dust onto paved surfaces that then get disturbed again with the traffic that follows. So those track out rules are in place. They're very strictly enforced, and we have leveled large fines at many, many of our community's finest home builders and contractors and construction companies and earth movers, and I get calls all the time, and that's why I'm thrilled to have an ombudsman on board to work with those folks, representing kind of a buffer or a go-between, if you will, between the department itself and the industry that's being affected. I will tell you that there's been a real learning curve, and because the economy has tanked like it has, there's not as much home building, there's not as much construction, there's not as much earth moving in the home building sector. There's still a lot of commercial work, and there's still a lot of public work going on. But we've learned through this learning curve, if you will, that, and we've had to back off a little bit in terms of the number of employees, inspectors in the field, and we've learned to deal with it more, I think, more efficiently for the taxpayer's sake, but effectively for the clean air sake. And we're more about education, more about making sure everybody understands the rules and is attempting to keep them, and less about big fines up front. At least that's what I've been told, and I want Holly to kind of follow through and share what she knows about that segment of it, because there are friends of yours and mine right here in this city who are not happy with Maricopa County's air quality department because of fines they've received. And lack of communication is the biggest problem. And so that's why we're here. That's why we have a staff. That's why we need your help, is because we've got to communicate effectively with every citizen and every business owner and every industry leader to make sure everybody knows what the rules are, and that when they violate them, they're effectively dealt with, whether it's a warning or a fine or whatever it may be. And the size of those fines is largely dictated, you may not know this, but it's largely dictated by the EPA. We are directly affected by the EPA's policies and federal law in the Clean Air Act. And they're not going to fine a major large company a small amount of money if because they'll just consider that part of their cost of doing business. These fines are designed to really be effective, and it's, I think, to some degree, it's been effective at this point. Hopefully, with the slowdown in the economy and the construction industry, people will become more educated and understand more the rules and be more diligent in keeping the rules, and that will have a positive effect. Holly, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, Mayor Smith, I do want to stress the importance, and back to one component of your question was, can we really do this? I do believe we can. I think it has become trend now to be earth-friendly. 4 years ago, going green was really not a common term. It is becoming a common term.
Well, I just wonder if in a desert, you know, you go through three dust storms a summer, and you're sitting there, we live in a desert. You're asking us to get rid of dust.
Right.
That's part of being in a desert. And I see that as a real uphill battle. I think even people who believe in green somehow don't get the connection of what they add to the atmosphere as it relates to dust and particulates. You know, they get it when you're talking about driving a car. They get it when it's a no-burn day, things like that. But to me, it's an uphill battle we all have to get people to understand that, yes, the natural environment adds a lot of the dust. I don't know if the EPA has figured that quite out yet. We need to get them out when the haboob's coming through. But normal people, even in the industry, construction industry, I mean, just quite say, listen, that's our environment that we live in. So how can we get them over that hump to say, okay, I'm going to change. I'm not going to use the leaf blower. I'm not going to do this.
Naturally occurring events.
Right. Yeah. Mayor Smith, there are two points I do want to touch on. One are the exceptional events that we have. So in the windstorm events, the state applies to EPA to say this was Mother Nature doing this. This wasn't human activity.
And by the way, that's a new phenomenon. The EPA has only in the last year and a half, 2 years,
right,
allowed those exceedances on naturally occurring windstorms and monsoon type activities to be exempted from the non-attainment scorecard, if you will. So we have made a little bit of progress with the federal agencies, and that's to their credit.
But that designation is tough to get. It's tough to get EPA to give us a waiver for a high wind event. And we get that comment all the time that we live in a desert. Of course, there's going to be dust. What the department maintains and Maricopa County maintains is that the natural desert has a stabilized crust. It's human activity that goes in and drives on it, digs it up, kicks it around, that creates that loose soil that when the wind does come in, it creates a significant problem. And the other point, Mayor Smith, that I wanted to touch on was, what is it going to take to get people to pay attention? If it isn't the health impact that over the last week during the high winds, if you didn't start coughing a little bit more, right on cue, or if you know it was a little troublesome to breathe for those of anybody in the audience that has asthma, if that's not going to motivate anyone to take action, I think sadly it's the threat of our federal transportation dollars, which not only will add to congestion in the valley, but we stand to lose even more jobs in an economy that we can't afford that. So it is important. We are in the situation that we're in for a federal mandate to clean up our air, and I really do want to drive home that our request tonight of the council is we would love to see a clean air ambassador in the city of Mesa. We cannot do this alone in Maricopa County. We need the help of city leaders such as yourself. So we would love to leave here with a clean air ambassador to help us with our cause.
Okay. Vice Mayor?
I was going to say, federal mandates are typically one size fits all, and we know that. And it's a reality that we aren't going to overcome. We live in the Southwest, and we know what we have. But even putting that threat of the loss of dollars aside, we need to do our best to make sure we clean up the air. That it's just a natural thing that we need to do regardless of the other consequences the feds are holding over our head. Are their formulas unrealistic for the Southwest? Yes, they are. But they're not going to change anytime soon. We know that. So the bottom line is we need to take every effort that we can to make sure we clean up in any way that we can. And a lot of that has to do with the exit the leaving construction sites, getting that dirt on our pavement and so forth, that's one of our biggest problems. And so whether they like it or not, they got to make the steps necessary to clean that up.
Okay. Any other questions? Councilmember Summers.
No question. I'll just make a statement. I think the other day I was watching, I think it was over the weekend, Channel 60, History Channel maybe, ran a very interesting show, 1920s, Great Dust Storms. And they reenacted some of those dust storms and what happened in Oklahoma and northern parts of Texas. What was fascinating about that is how, well, there are haboobs, or I don't know what they call them, the dust storms over in Texas as well, the impact that the human presence had made and how that exacerbated the problem throughout the region, because the natural grasses that held down the dust were scraped away to make room for cultivation, and when the corn died and there was a drought, like much like there is a bit now, although we're coming out of it, all that dust was just blowing around, and they reenacted a 70-mile-an-hour wind with the dust, and they invented at the time medical profession invented a new disease. It was called dust pneumonia. Killed hundreds. Fascinating show. You have to absolutely dig that out. But it went to demonstrate that while there is a natural level of dust in the environment in the desert, we're not the Sahara. You go out to the natural desert here in Arizona, you see a lot of grasses, a lot of brush and saguaro cactus. It's when we scrape that away for whatever human purpose we utilize it for, then exacerbates that dust problem and leads to a greater number of particulates. So I appreciate the program that you're putting forward. I have no idea what that, you're looking down or you're trying to write something. I have no idea what the name of the show was, but look on this History Channel over this weekend. But it was fascinating, the health effects that this can have if it's not addressed. So thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? I think that, you know, like Scott said, the city's historically taken a lead role in this activity, and I think that we want to continue that that position to be a leader. How we create this position or utilize our existing organization and do that, we'll have to sit down and talk about and figure it out. And Mr. Brady, you're looking down like you're looking away. We'll come up with something. We'll figure out, because we have a lot of advocates. So. Yeah, the question is how do we formalize that and be able to work with you in a more organized and formal method and manner, and I think we'll get something there.
That's probably a good plan.
Yeah, Councilmember Summers likes the plan with Councilmember Higgins. Just she's not here to volunteer. No, but we will get something.
Thank you for your time and your commitment,
Supervisor. Thank you so very much for coming down here. And bring a little Hollywood with you also. So, Holly, thank you, and everyone else, and Scott, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
We may have an actual regular council meeting to look at that stuff.
Yeah.
It'll still be light.
I think so.
It shouldn't be very late.
And if anyone would like to look at the van, it's pretty impressive outside, and we'll try and get that in either in between the meetings or right after the other meeting. Okay, the next item on the agenda is to go over tonight's agenda for the regular city council meeting. Page 2. Page 3. Page 4. Page 5. Page 6, page 7. Mr. Brady?
Just want to point out a few things on the agenda that I think is important, and I know Councilmember Higgins is not here, but we do have the, just pointing out, Fire Station 218, we have that bid in, which is favorable for the city with less than what we anticipated for the budget. You also see the purchase of property for a new star fire station on 6G, which is also good news as we look forward to locating future fire stations in the future. Just want to point that out for the public. We see it on front of us, but I think those are two pretty significant projects that we've been talking about as the council.
Actually, I think Councilmember Higgins, Councilmember Richens.
Well, Councilmember Richens for 218, Councilmember Higgins for
the
6G. Yes, thank you.
Okay. And how far are we, the budget as far as the bid and our estimate, how much are we?
I believe on the bid for 218, are we at a million?
It's a million
less,
two.
Million two. I was going to say million five, but million two less than what we had estimated for budget. Mm-hmm. And we want to spend a lot of time because I need to have the fire chief need to start working his way up here to make his presentation on the budget. I just want to bring that up, I think, from a just good news perspective, and also the 6G. We feel like we got a pretty fair price on the land there, which is less than we've typically paid for a parcel that size, and that will serve both District 5 and 6.
Good. Thank you.
Okay.
Congratulations on that. No, it's good. And it shouldn't be overlooked that once again, there's well over $1.5 million in savings there overall. So providing the same level of service for fewer dollars, that's a good thing. We'll move along now to the presentation on the budget issues from our fire department. Chief.
Good afternoon, Mayor, members of the council. Thanks for the opportunity to update you on some of the activities that we've been involved with. As you know, since last October, there's been quite a bit of change that we've been managing in the fire department, not only regarding budget challenges, but also major operational changes and opportunities to maintain the quality of service that we've traditionally provided here in the city of Mesa. On the second slide, getting right into it, you can see that in our current fiscal year, 08-09, we have eliminated about $3.7 million. That's just since October of this year. And you can see then in the 08 or in the 9-10 budget, there's going to be an additional $3.8 million. So you can see that we've taken great strides to reduce the costs of the fire department over these next 2 years. You might note that there are $0 there in the equipment for 09-10, and that's basically because the quality life tax is no longer available to provide equipment, and obviously that's something that we can't maintain forever. We'll need to readdress that in the future, but we are going to attempt to pull that off through fiscal year 9-10. And this budget process continues to be something that we manage almost month to month. As you know, the revenue stream fluctuates considerably and puts the city in a difficult situation, and sort of the same reaction then occurs within the other departments of the city, especially in the fire department. And so we're constantly working with the management team to be sure that we can help assist with meeting the budget requirements. The operational status essentially is an impact brought about by the budget reductions in particular. The items listed on this slide are simply 08-09 impact. And we're going to be talking about several of these items as we go through this presentation, but just to hit a few of them, we're making some major changes in the way we do our department training. We've canceled the paramedic class. We've postponed the battalion chief's test. And we've canceled the 2009 fire recruit class. Obviously, we're going to need to reinstate those at some future point. We also, and we'll talk more about it, eliminated engine 2201 and reassigned them out to station 217 as engine 219. We have, as you remember, back in October, we suspended the TRV program for a couple of months until we figured out what the budget implications were going to be, as well as a way to sort of reevaluate that program and get it back on track, which we have done since January. We have all the non-essential overtime has been frozen, which basically means if we don't have to do it to get through the day, we're not going to spend overtime on it. Several operational expenditures were reduced. We eliminated 9 sworn staff positions through attrition, and we eliminated 4 vacant civilian positions in that process. So that was just in fiscal year 08-09. As I mentioned before, we have been involved with some rather comprehensive changes for the fire department. And to the extent where we're beginning to call it a reinvention of the way fire and EMS is managed in the city of Mesa. There are 10 dot points on this slide that indicate 10 very detailed action plans that the fire department has been focusing on administratively ever since essentially October of last year. These represent the focus of the fire department for the foreseeable future. Each of these items is integrated. One depends equally on the other, and they must all be managed in unison. And if we're to make the changes we want to, maintain the quality levels of service and also improve our efficiencies. We'll talk more about each of these. This is sort of a we kind of boil them down into three categories. And if I might real quickly just talk about the TRV program. It's really an amazing story. We started out 2 years ago, actually no, 2.5 now, with a pilot program with something that was considered rather innovative. We found that it's very potentially going to be the staple of the way we provide basic life support service in the future. It also, however, is a program that has not been staffed and resourced, and so we have a significant challenge there. But you can see the items under implement TRV program, you can see they're rather far-reaching for the fire department. The first item we want to talk about in terms of reinvention is that, again, we did eliminate engine 2201 from downtown Mesa and reassigned it as 219 at fire station 217 in preparation not only to relieve the response time issues that we've been suffering there for a couple of years, but also prepare for the staffing of station 219. We go on to fire station construction, another major component of how we're going to manage fire service. Clearly, we appreciate the vote of confidence that the voters had in the fire department in providing these bond dollars through the election. Fire stations were authorized. Fire station 219 will be located at Elliott and Signal Butte, and there will be no additional firefighters added to open that station. Fire station 218 is a new station at 8th Street and Alma School, and there will be no new firefighters added to open that station. And refurbish of station, actually it's a rebuild of fire station 215 at Gateway was also approved, but it also will have no additional firefighters in that those positions already exist.
Chief, I think yes. Councilmember Summers has a question.
With the Chief, with the closing of 2201, what has that done to the call volume at Station 1 for the remaining units?
You know, it has been 3 months now. We have seen a jump in those, but we also have a TRV at Station 2. So when we moved 2201, we also put in a TRV at Station 202, and we began to see them pick up some of the BLS volume there. Although Station 2 itself is a very busy station, they're tending to run more downtown. In effect, we're beginning to see the TRV program do exactly what it was designed to do.
So it's been relieving the pressure off those companies so that they're not suddenly increasing in their call volume with the elimination of a unit?
They appear to have some minor increase in call volume at this point. We're watching it very closely.
Okay.
So everyone gets a geographic anchor. Station 202 is located
Stapley and 8.
Okay, so 8th Avenue. So they normally would not cover that, but now the TRV is driving into downtown to cover that.
Yes, one of the revisions we did to the TRV program is put them on automatic vehicle location and allow them to run based on their closest unit status, which for a BLS call could be as much as 4 or 5 mile radius.
Gotcha.
So we're beginning to see them.
Expanded the service area is what you've done.
Exactly.
With the TRV.
Yes.
Okay.
The next item, again, is really the kind of the first step that we really must take in order to really make the TRV program effective and maintain the minimum service levels that we've experienced in the past. And that is that the fire department is in the process of assuming responsibility for fire dispatch. We've been working very closely with the police department and communications department, and it appears as if we're going to be doing some remodel work on the second floor there to try to stay in the same facility. We have shut down one of our single person units in the field and reallocated that firefighter position to the dispatch center to help us not only get it up and running in terms of rewriting some algorithms, doing some training, as well as managing the deployment issues that go along with having a BLS response system along with an ALS response system. Again, BLS basic life support, ALS advanced life support response systems. So there's a tremendous amount of activity in that area. One of the more important things as well is to deal with the dispatch data and reporting system. As you recall, as a fire department, typically, We respond on fires and emergency medical calls. Because of that, we've always categorized our responses under those two general areas of service. And the reality is that we go on what we call high emergencies, which are structure fires and advanced life support medical calls. We also go on what we call low emergencies, which are basic life support and check hazard types of activities. In addition, we will go on social service calls, such as people that need assistance with after the fire issues, like the connectors do all the time, as well as just help with general services that don't need a fire truck response. And then we have service calls, which are people with their keys locked in their car, locked out of their house, and all kinds of other issues that people will dial 911. Part of the training we're going to do in the dispatch, and again, everything's integrated, so I hope I don't ramble here for you, but it's important that our public education group do education to the public regarding what's appropriate for a 911 call. Once we have that in place, the dispatchers need to understand what's appropriate for a 911 response and what the other alternatives might be. And then we can actually dispatch the TRVs on the low emergency types of calls and not compromise our ability to go to structure fires and advanced life support, if you follow me on that logic.
Councilmember Summers.
Chief, are we looking to integrate a 311 program for non-emergency calls? One of the issues with 911 is everybody can remember that number. I can't remember the 10-digit number for the fire department when I lock my keys in the car. Not that I ever have. If I did, I'd break my own window. But still, but a 311 number for those non-emergency calls that people recognize this is an emergency, whether it's police, fire, or anything else, but they could use some assistance. Are we looking at that?
The 311 system is available to the city, as you know. To my knowledge, there has been no particular design on how we would use that 311 system. And certainly as we begin to evaluate and collect data on the call volumes that we have, that would be a very reasonable and logical approach. However, if we do that, it would limit us in how we would want to use the 311 in the general city service application. So that's a thought process we need to walk ourselves through when we get there, but it's a good point.
Do we have information at all as to the percentage or number of our 911 calls that would be classified as non-emergency?
Mayor, members of the council, we have not collected data specifically on that, except to say that we do determine that some calls are what we call code 2. But since we are an emergency service department, we have typically dispatched most everything as emergencies. So that's one of the major reinventions.
The default is if someone dials 911, we err on the side of that it's emergency.
That's correct. Basically. That's correct. And we're going to be doing much closer evaluation of those calls in the future.
I'm just wondering if we've had any, like you see on the TV, where you have someone who didn't get, you know, what was it, shrimp, extra shrimp with their order, and those kind of things, which, you know, sound funny, but I'm sure they're not funny when you're sending resources out to take care of that. But we don't track that. We don't have that kind of data in our system as to.
Mayor, that's correct. And quite frankly, the public understands that there's some magic words that can get emergency response, and they will simply tailor their request to get the emergency response.
They're very creative.
They haven't had an alternative in the past. So we're looking at providing an alternative so that we don't have that impact on our emergency response capability. Mayor, to answer your question more directly, in general, about half of our emergency medical calls, which is about 40% of our overall calls, are what we call basic life support.
Right, the sprained ankle, the twisted knee, the not life threatening type of thing.
Correct.
Still a medical issue, but not one that would require hospitalization. You can take care of it.
That's correct, and you can imagine the algorithm work we're gonna need to do, because clearly a basic life support call that involves severe pain may take a different level of response than somebody that's suffering from flu symptoms for the past 3 days and they're beginning to have fevers that are reoccurring, and we have some time to go out and actually check on those people before they're an emergency.
I think you're raising an issue here that we don't have time to get into today, but as I go out, you know, people in the community are surprised to hear that in many ways, because of the social issues and political issues that are far beyond our ability in the city to control, that we have become the primary care physician for a large segment of our population. And this is not limited to one segment or another. It's across the board. Those without insurance, those, you know, many other people who only know 911 now look to the city and specifically to the fire department to take care of things like you're saying. Someone with a flu symptom should be going to a doctor. But they're calling us as a city to have a firefighter or an entire fire crew come out with this $750,000 piece of equipment to talk about flu symptoms. And, you know, that's a challenge we're going to continue to have. And I think our citizens need to understand the changing role of the demands that are placed upon us as a city government as it relates to medical services. This is something that didn't exist 20, 30 years ago. You would have never thought to call the fire department because, you know, you feel like you have the flu. It's now commonplace today. And yet our system of delivery, our system of funding, all of from our side has virtually remained the same throughout that time. And yet the world in which we're dealing has changed dramatically. And so I applaud you for looking at ways to change that and still keep the public's safety and the public service there while recognizing that we have got to change the way that we approach that issue. And I think our citizens need to understand that we're faced with different challenges and challenges that put a real strain on our resources. So enough of my pontificating.
Okay. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you for pontificating or stopping.
Thank you for your input. You started it, Mayor. We move on to the, because it's a good segue right into talking a little more about the TRVs. We currently staff the two TRVs right now at station 202 and 209. We're able to do that with the positions that we transferred from staff back to the field, as I mentioned earlier. In addition to low vacation and sick leave at this period, we have extra staffing. We're able to maintain that those two units without impact to overtime. However, the positions that we're using to fill those spots at this point will attrition out over the next 18 months. And it may be late May, but we at this point are planning to shut down our engine 218 and redistribute that staffing to the TRVs in order to maintain them in service without spending the additional overtime. However, as I mentioned before, station 218 is on track to open very soon, and there is no additional staffing available to staff that station. Therefore, we'll be at a point where we need to move those people off of the TRVs back to engine 218 to open that fire station. At that point, we do not have staffing for the TRV program. One of the key components of the TRV.
Vice Mayor, a question.
Yes, sir.
On that note, just a reminder to the public how long it takes to get a firefighter up to speed from the time he begins academy to staff those positions.
Councilmember Jones, thank you. There essentially is a 9-month process for us to actually do the recruiting and the training and to get a recruit into the field. It's about another, 9 months after that they have a probationary period. But we're really looking about 6 months to 9 months to recruit, hire, train, equip, and place those firefighters out on the fire apparatus.
So sometime in the next year, we have to have an academy started to fill those spots that we'll be losing in the next 18 months. Or we will not be able to staff the TRVs and 218.
That's correct, Councilmember Jones. However, we are at this point in a position to lose 30 positions through attrition. So until we've lost those 30 positions, we won't have vacancies. And so we won't need to have a recruit class. We'll be running short.
We'll be running short, but you won't, with the staffing that you have, with the attrition and when 218 comes on, we're either not going to be able to staff the TRVs or 218.
That's correct.
That's what I understand you just saying. So in order to be able to maintain that staffing, we're going to have to start a training class sometime in the next year, in the coming year, in order to meet that demand when it comes.
That may be correct. We do have other options. There are other engine companies that we may decide to redistribute that staffing. Each of those options has an impact on our ability to respond. As you know, we did lose one grading point in our ISO rating, and that's strictly based on our ability to respond to fires. It has nothing to do with EMS. So we are already behind in our ability to respond to fires, and we're trying to improve that situation by redistributing the calls to basic life support units to replenish that capability. But it is, we do have a challenge on both sides, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Fires aren't taking care of themselves with our current staffing levels. We're already at a disadvantage there, and yet we're trying to convert those to an EMS response system. On balance, we're going to come out to the good, but we still have needs in both arenas. It was mentioned earlier, Mayor, you mentioned that we have become more and more, especially under the economic conditions we're in, as the first resort call for a medical issue rather than a last resort. As one way that we have piloted, as you know, and to try to essentially deal with those issues yet insulate our emergency response system is to acquire physician's assistants to ride on our TRVs. Now, we've looked at that as seasonal at this point since it, and try to coincide that with the high call volumes that we experience during different parts of the year. It seems to be very effective. It seems to work well. It is in no way intended to replace urgent cares or emergency rooms or anything of that nature. It's simply to augment our response system where we end up with a 911 call and we have to make a decision about what's the appropriate resource to send there. We're also looking at, with some doctors groups, the ability to do cost recovery. Since they are licensed physicians, there is an opportunity for them to charge for those services and offset the costs. If they take a place on a TRV, then they essentially could potentially save us the cost of one position on each TRV where they're employed. Again, that would be based on their ability to do a collection on most of the patients that they would treat. So that is something we're looking at. We do see that as an opportunity for the future, but it is something that at this point, without some cost recovery, is going to be rather expensive. We're attempting at this point within the fire department to make a commitment to bring them online, even if it ends up costing us a little bit, as it did during our pilot. We think there's some opportunity to demonstrate to urgent cares and even some emergency rooms that there's a benefit for all of us players involved, and we may be able to develop a partnership to help resolve this issue on the front end. And then finally, to expand the AED program, as we implement a basic life support system in the city of Mesa, it's going to be very important to have as many people in our community trained on automatic electronic defibrillators as possible. We've seen a lot of very encouraging reports about the success of those devices. Staff is currently, with support from city council members, looking at the possibility of possibly structuring some sort of city ordinance that would provide for these devices, as well as training in high activity areas as well as high occupancy areas. So with these combination of efforts, we believe we're going to be able to maintain the quality level of service we've always known in Mesa, and yet reduce the costs on a per call basis.
Chief, you know, you got a little bit to go, and this is too important to rush you. And yet we're running up against a regular council meeting. I apologize for that. But we'd like to invite you back to Thursday's show if you want to come back.
We'd love
and
to
if you could come back, and we'll pick up right from where we left off there on the AED and go on with training and then get down to the side. Is that okay, Mr. Brady? If we could do that, because I don't want to cut your time, because this is too important of an issue to
sure,
to give you shortchange you or us. Okay?
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you very much. Let's very quickly acknowledge receipt of minutes from various boards. Got a second. Motion, a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Anything you need to let us know, Mr. Brady, before we go upstairs?
Just a couple of things real quickly. One, let me let the council know, we just got this today. If you recall, last year we received an upgrade from Standard & Poor's on our GEO rating, and that rating was affirmed once again this year. So that's good news considering all the economic challenges that we've gone through, and we'll get you more detailed report about what they suggest. And one of those I thought was interesting is, these are their quotes, strong economic environment. So good presentation, Mayor. And the next thing, just quickly, we do have some upcoming meetings and events we want to make the council aware of. Tomorrow night, District 5, Councilmember Higgins will be having a Building Stronger Neighborhood meeting, which will begin at 6:30 p.m., and that'll be at the Barbara Bush Elementary School. We also want to remind Council again, April 23rd, Thursday, we'll have our study session. This Saturday, April 25th, Falcon Field Airport is having an open house from 8 to 4 p.m., and we'll have all speak more about that on Thursday and give more information on that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. There's no other business? We'll adjourn? Got it. All in favor?
Aye.
We are adjourned, and we'll meet upstairs. Thank you.